I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics' viral tubing mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Okay. Hi, you're listening to Muses and Stuff, the podcast that's all about the dolls. They were the girlfriends, the groupies, the wives, and the muses who played such a huge role in rock and roll history by simply being themselves. They're sweet, sexy, and powerful. They ran after what and who they wanted, and they made no apologies. Welcome to the show. Hello, everybody. Today with me, I have my friend Lynx O'Leary. She is sitting across from me with her beautiful smile and her beautiful purple violet hair.
Yeah.
And we are going to talk about Marianne Faithfull today. So what's going to be different about this episode is that I'm not going to be the one telling the story. The summer when I had Marianne Faithfull's book in front of me, I just never really got around to reading it. I would pick it up and then I put it down and pick it up and then I put it down and I just didn't get around to it. So I sent out a message to all of my dolls and I said, who wants to come over and tell me a story about Marianne Faithfull? And all signs pointed to Lynx.
That's correct.
So Lynx, I'm going to introduce you in just a moment. But before we get into that, I need to do a little bit of corrections. So last week on the podcast, my friend Sam Murdoch came over and we recorded an episode after he played a show, after we went and got food. So it was very, 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 very late. And my brain is not great at that point. So one thing that I had said about my friend Corey was when Sam would call her up to the stage and he wouldn't play until she got there, I think I repeated like 5 times that Corey was outside smoking. And I think I might have said like, yeah, Corey was smoking a lot in those days. And I just, like, in her defense, want to say we all were. Okay. It wasn't just her. I'm sorry that I said that, Corey. I should have just said she was outside getting some fresh air, but you know what, we had our little rebellion stage then, and I'm sorry, girl, didn't mean to tell the world that you Big smoky smoke. One thing that I also said was Patty Boyd wasn't a groupie. I told, because I was trying to tell Sam the difference between groupie and muse, and how groupie is just definitely not a bad thing. And then I somehow said that Patty Boyd wasn't a groupie. But, I mean, she went on vacation with John and Cynthia, and she went to parties with Eric Clapton and everyone. You're hanging out with groups of musicians. Groupie.
Mm-hmm. Groupie and muse sort of, like, they go together. I don't think you can be a muse without being a groupie as well. But I think you can be a groupie without being a muse.
Bingo. Bingo, bingo. Okay, see, we're already 3 minutes into it, and Lynx is just hammering it down. Fantastic. And then the one other thing that I want to say before I give you a proper intro is that I was going to put some music into the podcast, and so I was just sitting around and fiddling with it, and I talked to this band called Swim, that's capital S. W-I-M-M, it's all capitals, and they are in LA right now. I think originally from Florida, and I met them in Toronto last year when they toured with Bright Light Social Hour, who are from Texas. And then after the show, they said to my roommate and I, you know, we've never been here before. You look like you know what to do on a Thursday night. Where should we go? So we went out and we played pinball, and it was great. They just released a song called Groupie.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
I think the video is coming out tomorrow, too. So I sent him a text message, and I said, do you mind if I play your song or like a part of your song on the podcast? And he was like, go for it. Yeah. So thank you, Chris. But then I realized, like, I'm really lazy and I don't have a producer and I'm really busy. And I might put it in. I might not put it in. It's kind of
undecided.
And it was a crazy weekend. So if that doesn't end up happening, I don't actually put it into the show, everybody should just go and check it out and listen to the song and watch the video, Groupie by Swim.
Awesome. I'm going to do that later.
Yeah. Okay. So Lynx, I'm going to give you your proper intro. And you told me that Lynx is your real name.
It is my real name, yes.
Just 1 second. So Lynx O'Leary, she is a writer, a lifelong music fan, a book reviewer, and you can find her hundreds of book reviews on Goodreads. I first met Lynx, we kind of met online because it was through Miss P's Toronto Dolls group. Mm-hmm. And then we met in person a few weeks ago when we had the writer's workshop here.
Yes, it was fantastic.
It really was. And you actually started the Toronto group.
Yes. I wrote Miss P about 5 years ago. Me and a friend had created a community on LiveJournal called Vintage Groupies. And it was sort of through that that I got the courage to write Miss P herself and just be like, hey, I'm an avid groupie fan, and I hear you're doing these writing classes, and I would love to be a part of one. Like, have you ever considered coming here? And she said, I'd love to. I don't know if there's enough women out there who would be interested. If you can find, you know, 8 to 10 girls who are interested, let me know. And so I sort of put the word out to all my friends who were into the whole groupie scene and were in love with Miss P, and we kind of spread out and we got enough, and it ended up being like over 20 girls there. It was incredible.
When I found out that this group existed, I was floored. I was so excited. So I went for the first time 2 summers ago. Mm-hmm. And it's been life-changing, and meeting the girls in the group have been. And I know I talk about it almost every single episode, but
it's truly one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Just everyone is so supportive and loving and talented. Like, every person in this group, like, brings something special. It's an amazing community.
It's
great to see it build each time Miss P comes back as well. It's a really great mix of people.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Are you having a good weekend?
Yeah. It's been quiet, which is lovely. Just reading a lot and sort of hibernating.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, I'm really excited to just... I've got curlers in my hair because I'm going to go do a photo shoot later for the podcast, which is going to be my first kind of official photo shoot, which will be fun because I've done everything myself. I've done all the photos. I've done everything. So this will be great.
That's exciting.
I started off my weekend pretty rock and roll, FaceTiming with the sweetest and most handsome young man in Liverpool.
Ooh.
Yeah. So hello. Hello to you. And I went and saw a show last night. And now we're here. Had breakfast with one of my favorite East Coast rockers, and now here we are. And I'm ready to learn about Marianne Faithfull.
That's great.
I did my homework. I listened to the two songs.
Great. Okay, great. We're gonna get to that in a while.
Okay.
First, I want to say I was thinking about how I got into groupies and all of that. And I thought it was really funny that I happened to be the one talking to you about Marianne Faithfull, because I believe I was about 11 or 12 and I was really into the Rolling Stones. And that was like just when the internet was sort of evolving into what it's become. And I would search for photos of Keith and Mick, and and I came across photos of them with Marianne and Anita Pallenberg, and I was like, who are these women? Like, how did they get to be there for all of this? And it was sort of through them that I became fascinated with groupies and muses. And I think Marianne's was actually the first autobiography I ever read of a groupie. And it's amazing that I'm here now.
I know almost nothing about her.
Well, you prepare yourself. She has got a fantastic story. It's crazy. You're in for a shock, but a good one.
Okay.
All right. So she was born in 1946, had a pretty normal childhood, raised by her mother, who was a little bit eccentric. Her real like rock and roll story doesn't begin until she's 17. So let's...
That's a good age.
Yeah. Well, we're going to start from there. So she's 17. She's dating a man named John Dunbar, who would become somewhat well-known in the London scene. I believe he's owned some art galleries and things like that. He was friends with Peter Asher, who happens to be Jane Asher's brother. Mm-hmm. And they were invited by Peter to come to a record release party of some pop star. So they go to this party. This happens to be the first time she sees Mick Jagger. He's at this party. He is at the time dating Chrissy Shrimpton, and they're having a massive row in front of everyone at the party, which apparently was not too unusual a sight in those times. So she caught sight of him, thought he was just an idiot.
She's 17.
Yes.
Okay.
But Mick Jagger isn't the only Stones person at this party. Andrew Luke Oldham was there. He was a major player in the Stones history. He produced a lot of their records. He sees Marianne, looks at her across the room, and sees, quote, an angel with big boobs.
Okay.
And he walks right over to her and is like, I need you. I need to sign you. Like, you've got something. So
she sure did.
Yeah. So within a week, she's getting telegrams from him being like, come to the studio. Let's do something here. So she goes to the studio and they just start recording some songs. Nothing's really working until Andrew decides, hey, why don't you play As Tears Go By, which just happened to be a song that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards had recently written. It was their first song that they actually wrote together. They were only covering songs at that point. Right. And Andrew's actually responsible for them starting to write. He told them, like, go, you need to start writing your own stuff. If you want to make it big, like, get in there and make your own material. Like, so she sings this song. It's perfect for her. Records it. A little rock and roll trivia here. Jimmy Page happens to be the studio guitarist.
Yes! Oh, nice. Nice. So he just asked her then to go in and start recording a song based on her big eyes and her big boobs?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. Well, it's a good thing she could sing then.
Right? Yeah. And just crazy opportunity knocks, and she just was like, yeah, might as well, right? So... just like that, she's got a hit record, and she begins touring. And back then, they did like these pop tours where all the people who had singles out would kind of tour together, even if they didn't really mesh well.
Okay.
It's on these tours that her first sort of groupie experiences start to happen. She ends up having little affairs with Jeremy from Chad and Jeremy, Alan Clark from the Hollies, and Gene Pitney, who A Town Without Pity apparently is a great lay.
Oh.
Yes.
Juicy.
Yeah. And because she's with Andrew with producing and everything, she's sort of seeing the Stones here and there. But yeah, mixed with Chrissy, but he's a massive flirt. She's not having any of it. She's like, no. She's still
hard to get.
She's still with John Dunbar. So they are in a pretty serious relationship, and she gets pregnant.
Oh, no way.
Yes. And Dunbar proposes, and a week before they were planning to get married, Bob Dylan came in town. He's staying at the Savoy. Marianne, like every woman, is like in love with Bob Dylan and listens to his records just constantly. And it's so special, like just listening to his lyrics, reading into his lyrics. So she goes and she's got her eyes set on him. Who cares that she's pregnant and, you know, engaged. I think he was away.
It's Bob Dylan.
Exactly.
All bets are up.
So she goes. It's like a big party there for 2 weeks. She spends most of it talking to Allen Ginsberg, really not talking to Dylan. She's too terrified. But over the course of a week or so, she starts hearing from other people at the party that Dylan has a thing for her.
Yeah.
And, she hears that Dylan's writing her this love letter, and she's like getting more and more anxious and nervous and everything. And then finally the day comes when they're all alone, and Dylan's like, do you want to hear my new album? She's like, yeah. And it was Bringing It All Back Home. Mm. And they put it on over and over again, and they sit there, and Bob Dylan goes over each song, each lyric, and like tells her what it's all about and just deciphers it all for her. It's like this perfect rock and roll moment. But as he's doing this, she's getting more and more terrified. She's still like 18 at this point. So they're about to like get it on, and she's like, I can't do it. She freezes up.
Oh, Marianne.
Yeah. And then Dylan gets really upset, and she's like, well, I'm pregnant and engaged. And he just has like a temper tantrum. And apparently he ripped up the love letter and kicked her out.
Because he couldn't just have what he wanted when he wanted.
Exactly.
He wanted.
Just,
oh, Bob, right? I would have hoped for more from you.
Even these amazing rock gods are just flawed humans underneath, you know, scared, the ego shattered. Just
oh yeah, I'm doing Bowie next week. Can't wait get into that.
So after that experience, Marianne is like, all right, well, I'm going to get married. I'm going to have my baby. They do. She's 18 when they get married. John Dunbar's 22. They have a son named Nicholas.
Catherine James had a child really young too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty soon after this that the whole 60s housewife suffocation begins, where she realizes John Dunbar just wants a housewife, not a pop star, not a, someone who's gonna be smoking hash and having fun like he is, you know, do as I say, not as I do type of situation. And Marianne, that's not the life she's destined for. So she starts rebelling, and her way of rebelling is going out and partying with Keith Richards and Brian Jones and Anita Pallenberg. And it's in this time that she becomes best friends with Anita. She's dating Brian Jones at the time.
Okay, I was going to say, was she dating Keith?
No, not quite yet.
Okay.
Apparently, her and Brian Jones had a house together. But Keith Richards didn't really have a house. He's just pretty much stayed at Brian and Anita's. And Marianne was just over there constantly. So it was sort of like the four of them always, doing hash, acid, just having a blast, living the rock and roll life.
Just dropping the kid off with the grandparents.
Yeah.
Sally,
yeah,
rock and roll waits for no one.
Exactly. On one of these excursions, Marianne went to see the Stones play just outside of London, and she didn't have a place to stay. She didn't book the hotel or anything. She just went with them, and sort of because of this, or I should say first, they were playing with Tina Turner that night.
Oh, cool.
If you read her book, she has a great little story about Tina trying to teach Mick how to dance. It's pretty funny. One of Tina Turner's backup dancers and Marianne were sort of hanging out in Mick's room, having that situation where it's like, which one's going to leave first? Which one's going to stay?
I just talked about a standoff between Patti Smith and Cherry Vanilla with Chris Christopherson.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was last week's episode. And actually, I'm bringing back Cherry Vanilla for the next.
Cherry is fantastic.
For next episode with Angie and
Bowie. Yeah.
So actually, Cherry Vanilla shared last week's episode.
Cool.
Thanks, girl. Sorry.
It's all right. Anytime someone brings up Cherry is a good thing. So Marianne wins, of course. And from this one night stand, the song Let's Spend the Night Together.
No.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Oh, boom. And that's the name of Pamela's book where she talks about all of them.
Exactly.
All of the ladies. I mean, Marianne's not in that book, but
no.
Quite a few of my choices have come from reading that book, and I had no idea.
A lot of amazing ladies, yeah.
Oh my God, yeah.
So the thing is, Marianne still isn't really into Mick. The truth is, she's in love with Keith Richards. And they have what she calls the best night of her life. They spend a night together. It's just magical, fantastic. But he just crushes her in the morning because he says, like, you know, Mick's not really a bad guy. Like, you should really give Mick a shot.
Ooh.
Yeah. So she's, like, heartbroken. But the truth is, as we all know, Keith is in love with Anita Pallenberg. So he's got his sights set elsewhere. And Marianne sort of just accepts this and is like, all right, I'll give Mick a shot. Mick is still with Chrissy, but once Marianne lets him know, I'm interested, let's give this a shot, he dumps Chrissy. Marianne moves in with Mick and her son. They move in with Mick while Chrissy is like moving out.
Mm-hmm.
They actually sort of cross paths. Chrissy's a pretty sad story. She was also a muse to Mick. Heartbreakingly so. You can find out all about their relationship in two songs, Under My Thumb and 19th Nervous Breakdown.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's what happened. She had a nervous breakdown right after that. She was hospitalized. It was not the best scene for Chrissy. But Mick and Marianne are falling in love now, and everything's roses for them, and they sort of forget about Chrissy.
And so this is, are we in the late 60s at this point?
No, they're still like 19. So it's like 66.
Oh, okay. 67. So still
it's very early still. Mid-60s.
Yeah. Okie doke.
So they're together for a really a while now. Things are wonderful. Her son Nick is living with them. They're one happy family. And the next big sort of incident in their history happens with the infamous Rolling Stone drug bust.
This one I do know about. Yes. So that's like the one thing that I know about Marianne Faithfull. No, is what was she wearing during the infamous drug bust?
Yes. So they were at a cottage. They'd gone out all day. Marianne's clothes were dirty. She took a bath. She's letting her clothes dry or something. And then the police raid them. She happens to be wearing a fur rug, a very large fur rug, and naked underneath. And of course, a huge deal is made about this. And a terrible rock and roll folklore story where people start saying Mick and her were making love with a Mars bar.
I've never heard that.
Really?
Doesn't sound like the worst thing in the world.
No, but in the 60s, and this is actually in print, it's not the best for one's reputation.
Fair enough.
And completely ludicrous, but unfortunately, it really did stick to her, and it's still a story that some people believe, others see it for the silliness it is. Anyway, this drug bust is really big. The man, Norman Pilcher, he is like the head of the drug squad, and he has a vendetta against rock and rollers. He just wants to take rock down. He busts Mick and Keith in this. Brian Jones soon after. He also busted Donovan, John Lennon. He just really had it in for rock and rollers.
He's just jealous.
Yeah, pretty much. But it's a big deal at first. Like, they're facing jail time. They really did think that they were going to go to jail. They went to court. They were demonized in the press. It wasn't until like just before the court case that people started to see it for what it was, which was like a total setup, ridiculous. And so the tide turned for them, luckily, and they were able to move on from it. This man, Norman, he actually ended up doing his own jail time.
What'd he do?
Well, he was caught like setting up drug busts and stuff. So it makes a lot of sense once you find that out. It's just smear campaigns. And they managed to get through it. It's around this time that Anita leaves Brian for Keith. Brian Jones beat Anita quite often. Mm. He was violent with her, so she's better off with Keith. They are ostracizing Brian. They don't really want him in the band anymore. He's sort of like their punching bag for a while. So he's slowly exiting the scene. So now it's the foursome between Mick and Marianne and Keith and Anita, and they're just having fun, traveling.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, just having a wonderful time. Then Anita and Mick do a movie called Performance together. This is like 1968. If you haven't seen the movie, it's fantastic. I highly recommend it.
I haven't.
Really?
Maybe that's what I'll do tonight. It's wonderful. I'm going to watch it tonight. It's wonderful. Okay.
And Anita tends to get into her roles very deeply. She's in a lot of films. Barbarella is another fantastic one. Her character in Performance happens to be with Mick, and they end up having an affair on set. And so Keith and Marianne aren't anywhere near the set, but they know what's happening, but they don't want anything to do with it. It is a betrayal. They're both hurt, but accepting of it in a weird 60s kind of way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the weird 60s, your band is blowing up.
Yeah. It's painful, but it's happening.
Yeah.
And I guess it's also around this time that Mick and Marianne both start having affairs. They start that unhealthy thing where it's like, well, if you're doing it, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to one-up you, and then I'm going to one-up you. So the affairs are sort of getting out of control. But then Marianne gets pregnant again with Mick's baby. So she goes off to Ireland while he's making Performance. Needless to say, they lost the baby. She had a miscarriage. Then Brian Jones passes away. So all these things start happening that are breaking down the fun.
Did he get hit by a car or did he drown in the pool?
He drowned.
Okay.
Yeah. They were all really terrible to him in his last year. So between his death and the miscarriage and the cheating and everything, it's all piling up on Marianne. She's pretty depressed at this time. They do that Hyde Park tribute to Brian. And then about a week later, Mick and Marianne had gotten parts in the movie Ned Kelly. So they flew off to Australia to do this film. But Marianne was just so upset over the way everyone was treating Brian's death. Like it was just something that happened and something that you might as well just get over it type of thing, that she ended up taking 150 Tylenols. Mm. She went into a coma, obviously. She almost died. Luckily, Mick found her in time, got her to the hospital. Apparently, when she came to, he said, "I thought I'd lost you." And she said, "Wild horses couldn't drag me away."
Yeah.
Yeah. So she starts to get better health-wise, at least. Mick goes off for a tour. And it's around this time that Mick and Pamela DeBar have their affair.
Okay.
Marianne sort of knows about it because when he came back from America, he asked Marianne if she would try these ice cream flavor douches. And so she was like, clearly some woman in America got this idea in his head, but she didn't know who.
Was it Pamela?
It was.
What?
That's, yeah.
I thought I knew everything there was to know about Miss P.
It is in
Miss P. You naughty girl.
It is in Miss P's book. And that's how Marianne found out.
How did I miss that?
I don't know.
It's in, let's no, it's
I don't
in,
think she mentions.
I'm with the band.
I think so, yes. And I don't think like Miss P mentions Marianne or anything. But it's when Marianne reads Miss P's book in the late 80s, early 90s that she puts two and two together and is like, oh, this is the woman he was sleeping with in America.
Whoa.
Yeah. So at this point, hash and acid start to become heroin for Marianne. She's doing drugs really heavily. It's pretty bad for her.
And I mean, she's probably has that addictive personality.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes if, oh man, I would be worried about myself if mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, like a little bit of hash, all right, a little bit of acid,
and
okay.
It's then just all of a sudden
you're with, yeah, Mick yeah. Jagger and Keith Richards, and then, yeah. Oh man.
And Keith and Anita were very heavily into the drug scene as well.
Yeah.
And so they were all hanging out together, so it was just always there. She also is very unhappy with the way her career is going. She's still doing music, pop music, and she's acting in plays and a few film roles here and there, but they sort of marketed her as this beautiful, ethereal English rose, this perfection kind of thing, and clearly that's really not who she is inside, so...
Perfection is an illusion.
Mm-hmm. So... She's pretty unhappy. Mick Jagger is strumming a guitar and doing his thing, and Marianne starts to write lyrics, and she ends up writing the lyrics for Sister Morphine. They record it with her singing, and it gets released as a record, and she's finally happy about putting out something of herself. But like within a week, her record company took it out of circulation and just was like, no, like this is not happening. So she's pretty crushed about that too. And yeah, things are starting to get rocky in their relationship. She never really toured with the Stones. And one of the reasons for this is a situation that happens in Italy, I believe, where she surprised Mick with a visit. And apparently on this tour, there was really like violent energy, riots, and just not a good scene. And in her book, she recounts a story where she surprises him and he came into the room and immediately walked up to her and just started slapping her and hitting her. And without speaking, and she like,
whoa.
Yeah, she ran to the bathroom. He followed her. He beat her up quite bad.
Mick.
Yeah.
Okay.
And apparently, like, after it happened, they never spoke about it again. He was like never, ever violent to her ever again. She says it was like he was possessed, and it was like it wasn't him. And they never, ever discussed it ever again. So like, she doesn't even really know why it happened.
Patty Boyd was never allowed to go on tour with the Beatles the whole time that she was married to George Harrison and in a relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't go. She wasn't on one tour with him.
Yeah. And I mean, we all know why. They were lovely ladies in every other city. And I guess the guys wanted to let loose. And
they needed that illusion of singleness.
Exactly. So, yeah.
My friend Sam actually last week made a pretty funny point about the musicians who have the profile pictures with their girlfriends and wives in there. Mm-hmm. That's today's indication of don't poke me.
Yeah.
Those were his words.
Yeah, yeah. Usually.
Otherwise, yeah.
If they're putting them out there, then... That's the sign, yeah. Don't come near me. Don't send me signals.
Don't come around here no more.
So Marianne's like falling out of love with Mick at this point. They're both unhappy about it, but they know what's happening. There's this one sort of last grasp at hope where Mick comes in and is like, I want you to listen to something. Apparently he really talked about emotions through music, never actually sitting down and discussing feelings. So they sat down on the floor and were cross-legged looking at each other in the eyes, and he put on Wild Horses. And they sat there like listening to it and both in tears crying because they sort of knew it was the end.
Shit, what a song.
Right? I should also mention, just so you know, you can't always get what you want. While not totally about Marianne, is definitely, there's Marianne in that. And that's around the same time that this is all happening as well. So they finally break up. Marianne is like a full-blown heroin addict.
She's shooting it?
She never really mentions if she is or not. I know at first she certainly wasn't, but...
I guess it'll eventually comes down to that.
Yeah, I think it's safe to assume that it definitely did get to that point.
I just saw a picture in Angela Bowie's book. You know, they have that section in the books with all the black and white photos, and there's just one of Marianne Faithfull just kind of like looking sleepy. And it, she said she always got it together for her performances.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No matter how strung out or whatever she was, she always... pulled it together.
So yeah, they break up. She's unhappy with the pop career. She's a junkie. She loses custody of her son, Nicholas, who goes to live with his father again, John Dunbar, who happens to be dating Jean Shrimpton, Chrissy Shrimpton's sister.
Oh, it's a small rock and roll world, right? Isn't it? Even in this day and age, yeah. It really
oh,
is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's pretty funny, the connections that you can make.
Oh, God.
And...
yeah. So, Marianne has no money, no home. She's homeless. She begins living on the street.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
No.
She finds this old bomb site from, you know, the war, and she starts living on a wall, like literally living on a wall. She does this for a while. She tries rehab once. The nurse ends up punching her in the face, breaking her two front teeth because she smuggled in some heroin, and that was...
I was like, why? Because she was she jealous that like she was Mick Jagger's girlfriend? No.
No. That was some bizarre form of treatment, I guess. So that doesn't work out. She records another album with the missing teeth. It's garbage. She doesn't like it. It's still not what she wants to be doing. She meets a man named Oliver Musker who... takes her to this doctor who uses this crazy form of reverse psychology on her where he's like, yeah, you're too much of a junkie. Like, you're not going to get clean. And she's like, well, I will show you. And she does get clean for a while. She works in film, does plays. Bowie asks her to perform with him in 1974.
Okay.
They do.
See, I haven't gotten to that part in Angela's book because I'm only around 1972 right now. I'm halfway through this book and I'm just about there.
She'll definitely be
interesting.
Be in it. Yeah. They do a couple songs. They do I Got You, Babe. And Bowie asks Marianne to wear a nun's habit. So she's in a nun's costume. Bowie's in one of his fabulous get-ups. It is on YouTube. I highly suggest.
At this point, if Bowie tells you to do something, 1974 Bowie, you're doing it.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So she is dating this guy, Oliver. He's sort of got a violent streak to him. He's moody. They're not meant to be together, but he's sort of helping her get her life back together. Them two and David and Angie hang out a lot. She talks about one night that they were all having dinner together and her and Bowie went off into a corridor and she tried to give him a blowjob And apparently Bowie could not keep it up because he was so terrified of Oliver in the other room. Even though, again, it's the 60s, 70s scene and like it really did not matter, but it wasn't the greatest, didn't really work out. But they remain friends, and that's a really important moment for her because performing with Bowie and, you know, getting a relationship with him inspires her to start writing her own material and realizing, like, if she wants to change her career, it's up to her to do so, sort of. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Oliver asks Marianne to marry him. She says no. They break up. And she pretty much goes back to the wall and is a junkie again.
No, yeah. Don't go back to that wall, girl.
It's at that wall that she meets Bren Brearley, who ends up being her second husband. This is 1976. He's also a junkie.
Oh, okay.
They start living in a squat together. Yeah, no electricity, no hot water, just bare minimum. They actually literally sing for their supper. They go around to houses and perform for food. It's you're like classic junkie life here. But both of them are musicians, and they decide to form a band. They tour together, but they realize they're not really meant to be in a band together. So they both separately form their own bands. And another little rock and roll story. Ben ends up in a band called Blood Poets. And
cool
one
name.
Yeah. And one of the guys in that band would go on to marry Angie Bowie.
Hey! Cool. Okay.
So she gets a brand together, and it's about this time that she comes across a song called Why'd You Do It? And she did not write this song.
Okay.
But the minute she hears it, she's like, this is my song. This is exactly what I want to be doing, what I want to be saying. Like, this song was meant for me. So she goes to the guy who wrote it, and he's like, I'm sorry, I want either Tina Turner or Mick Jagger to sing this song. And she's like, no, this is my song. And she basically pleads with him until she convinces him to give it to her. They record it. It becomes like a small hit.
That song's intense.
It's amazing.
I hadn't heard it before until last night. So I played the first one, and I was sitting in my kitchen, and I had the speaker going, and then that song came on, and I just heard my roommate from the other room go, oh.
Yeah, it's intense. It's like, it's a more intense You Oughta Know by Alanis Morissette.
No kidding.
Yeah, people tend to think about Alanis's song when thinking about calling out a cheater, but Marianne beats her like so hard. Like that song just, you can feel it. You can hear in her voice that she means every word.
Yeah, and there's no even like playing on words. There's no alluding. There's no suggesting. It is just plainly out there.
Yes. She says when she first sang the song to her band, which was all men, they had like their jaws just dropped by the end of it. Like, couldn't believe that she was saying these words, and she got a real kick out of it. And it is personal to her. You do think that she wrote it. Apparently Mick Jagger thought that it was about him. But actually all the feeling that she was putting out there was because Ben was also a cheater. And so she was going through that at the time that she wrote it, but she was still with him. They actually ended up getting married in 79. So it was like during this time that she recorded that song. And because that song became somewhat of a hit, they were able to make a full record. And that record was Broken English.
Okay.
That was sort of considered her like a masterpiece of hers. Three very important songs came out of that. Why'd You Do It, Broken English, and a song called The Ballad of Lucy Jordan. She wrote the other two. She didn't write Why'd You Do It, but she wrote the other two. The Ballad of Lucy Jordan is sort of her story, had she become that housewife that John Dunbar wanted her to be. It's a very interesting, lovely song. You should check that one out as well.
Okay, I will.
So
whatever you say, Lynx.
So she's 33 now. She's made Broken English. And if you listen to As Tears Go By and then Why'd You Do It, the tone of her voice is just so different. Like, you wouldn't even assume it's the same person singing
totally.
Those two songs. And that was like only like 12, 13 years apart. But you can hear that she's lived like hard since that first song.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did think like, okay, I'm curious to know what the hell happened.
Yeah. What happened in those years?
The answer is heroin.
Yeah. Something really magical happens from this album, Broken English. Bob Dylan happens to come back into town. So apparently he sort of summoned her through mutual friends. Marianne is called to come. She does, not knowing that she's about to re-meet Bob Dylan. She enters her friend's apartment and there's Bob sitting there waiting for her. And of course, right away, she's like, oh my God, the nerves. And he sits her down and he's like, I've never forgotten our encounter. Like, I regretted it so much. And apparently he, out of his wallet, he like pulls out a picture of her when she was like 17, 18, like when they met. And he like has this photograph of her.
I've held on to this. Yeah. I've carried it with me everywhere I went. Is she, so at this point after the drugs, the wall, mm-hmm. the, all of these things, is she still beautiful?
Or she's still beautiful, but she's still a junkie.
Okay.
She does look, I would say she probably looks a little older than 33, but she's still got, you know, this sexiness to her and she's still got it. Okay. So her and Dylan are sitting down having some tea and he says, I heard Broken English. I thought about our time together and our broken encounter. And she realizes he somehow read into Broken English thinking it was about him somehow. And so Marianne is like, well, do you want to listen to my album? And he's like, yeah. So they end up having the exact same encounter that they had when she was 18 with his album.
Nice.
But she puts on hers and they listen to it over and over and over again. And she sits him down and explains every song, every lyric, just like he did his. And they just spend the whole night like that. And he says, if ever you need me, or if ever, if only I could, I'd write you that letter again. Right?
Damn.
And so they have this lovely encounter, and then they parted at dawn, and that was it. Just no relations or anything, just this beautiful moment spent together. It's also through Broken English that she's able, for the first time, to tour the States. She goes over to New York. She's asked to play Saturday Night Live and the Mud Club the same night. So this is a massive deal. Everyone knows how important Saturday Night Live is. She never as Angie Bowie says, she never would take drugs before a performance. She knew she had to be there for that, you know, clean. So, but nerves got the better of her, and she happened to ask a backup singer if they had any cocaine, and they ended up giving her procaine, which freezes vocal cords.
What?
Yeah. Apparently this backup singer was not a friend. Kind of jealous of Marianne. Purposely did this. So she walks up to the mic.
No, for SNL.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this broken whisper, shaky voice comes out, and she is just crushed.
That's horrifying.
Right? She manages to get through the performance. She thinks it's just a disaster. I should mention, Anita Pallenberg happens to be living in New York at this time. I'm pretty sure her and Keith are done. So Anita's backstage, and Marianne goes back to her, you know, just wanting to bawl her eyes out, so upset. And Anita comes in. She's like, oh, my God, that was amazing. Like, you were fantastic.
Okay. Yeah.
Just being like a doll, a best friend, always supportive. And Marianne's like, no, that was like, it was awful. I'm supposed to go to the Mud Club now. Like, I can't do this. And Anita was like, no, like, you're going to the Mud Club. You're going to kick butt. You're going to become the punk diva you were always meant to be. Like, this is your time. Like, you go and do it. And so she.
So then everybody thought that her performance was premeditated and that she meant to do that?
Well, people thought drugs. People thought she was on drugs. You could tell it wasn't meant to be like that, but it was nowhere near as bad as she thought it was. It just sort of came out as a sort of style, maybe a little drugged out, but a style nonetheless. So no, it didn't like ruin anything. And she kicked butt at the Mud Club, and she decides to move to New York. So her and Ben, they go over to New York. She spends about 5 years there. Unfortunately, New York is an even worse place for a junkie to be than England. And she gets like real bad into the drug scene there. Like, you thought it was bad before. Well, this is like levels. She ends up, after a couple of years, finally getting the royalties from Broken English, and just wastes it away on drugs. And she starts this new kind of habit of she would decide that she needed to get clean and go to Jamaica for like 6 months, and then come back and then be okay for a tiny bit and then get back into it and then do that again. And just it sort of became a habit. Her and Ben are rocky, of course. He ends up cheating on her with a woman who is married to a record producer or something. And this woman also wanted to be a singer. She actually had the audacity to cover Why'd You Do It? She's like, that's pretty ballsy. So they're about broken up. Ben ends up in some sort of drug scandal and gets deported anyway. And Marianne sort of takes that as a sign. She doesn't go back with him. She just sticks on in New York. So
good for you, girl.
Yeah. Her and Anita are basically living the junkie life together in New York, just still going hard, rock and roll, drugs. Marianne records another album, but it's never released. It's pretty bad. Her record company finds out just how bad she is on a visit to her squat. And they're like, this enough's enough. Like, we're getting you into a rehab. So
thank God.
Yeah. Yeah. So she goes to this rehab. I think she's there for like 8 months or something. She meets a man there. his name is Howard Tose, and they ended up falling in love. It's an unhealthy thing to fall in love at rehab with another junkie.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I think that's frowned upon, but they didn't let that stop them. And so when they both left rehab, they ended up living together. But after a few months, Marianne realizes, I'm never going to stay clean if I stick with this man. Because he was like even worse than she was. And she knew she couldn't help him. Like, he belonged in a hospital. So she finally got the courage to tell him, I'm going to go back to England. Like, I can't be here. Like, you need to go to a hospital. And he's like, okay. And she's like, all right, I'm going to make some tea. So she goes to make some tea, and he jumps out their 36-story window.
I was going to say, what did he do?
Yeah.
Okay.
36 stories, he's dead. So that's like obviously a huge thing to deal with. And I guess maybe like a final wake up call for her, where she's like, I can't live like this anymore. This is it. Before this happened, she tried to commit suicide again as well. Thankfully unsuccessfully. But yeah, this was like, she was finally at the point where life really did have to change. So she starts going to AA, and she married her third husband, but that only lasted like a year and a half. So it was like a quick marriage. She ended up moving to Ireland, building an actual lovely home for herself. She ended up writing her book, Faithful, and playing music and, you know, just living the life that she should be living.
The serene countryside.
Exactly.
With
exactly.
All of those sheep and.
Exactly.
I've been to Ireland. I had a great time. I loved it. But it's pretty relaxed there.
Yeah. Sounds like a good place to heal.
Yeah.
So yeah, she finally got clean, and she continued to make albums and be in plays and lots of music. In the 90s, her and Anita made a guest appearance on the TV show Absolutely Fabulous.
Nice.
Together. They played the God and the Devil.
Who played who?
Marianne was God and Anita was the Devil.
Funny.
Anita was sort of known as like this black magic witch.
I can't wait for her episode.
Yes.
Okay.
She is fabulous. So yeah, she would always be the Devil. Actually, in like the late 80s, I think, Marianne, Anita, and Mick were denounced by the Vatican as like a coven.
Sweet. Yeah. May I just say that the way that you're gripping the microphone stand right now is so sexy. Damn. Okay. Rock and roll.
So yeah, Marianne has had it pretty good since. She had a 15-year relationship with her manager. She had some health issues. She apparently had hepatitis C in the 90s, probably as a result of, you know, being a junkie.
Oh, yeah. Something had to have come out of that. Mm-hmm. You know, for to be able to walk away just totally
fine. Yeah.
Totally fine from years of
Absolutely.
Heroin use and abuse. It would be incredible. But okay. So I guess like Hep C isn't the worst thing that could ever happen.
Yeah.
Considering. All right.
She's lucky she happened to be a junkie like a little earlier mm-hmm. than what we all know happened in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
She also survived breast cancer in 2000s. And she's been healthy ever since. And
she's alive.
She's alive. She's turning 70 on December 29th.
Oh, man. Yeah. This month. Yes. Well, I mean, happy early 70th birthday. Yes. Holy shit.
And yeah, through her career, she's worked with directors like Godard, Jack Cardiff, Gus Van Sant, Sofia Coppola. And throughout all of her albums, she's released 22 records through her entire career.
What?
Yeah. And some of the amazing people she's worked with are like Steve Winwood, Keith Richards, Van Morrison, Tom Waits, Daniel Lanois, Emmylou Harris, Roger Waters, Beck, Jarvis Cocker, Billy Corgan, Ryan Adams, PJ Harvey, Nick Cave.
She's respected as
absolutely.
As all.
Yeah, everyone wants to work with her. She gets everyone. I actually saw her perform here in Toronto about a decade ago at the Mod Club.
Whoa.
It was fantastic. She really has this magic presence on stage. Like, you can't help but just be drawn in. Her voice is just so compelling and powerful. She was really something. I still have the set list. I managed to get
good
it.
Good for you. Yes. That's a good groupie. Yeah. You getting that set list.
It's part of my rock and roll memorabilia. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
That was an incredible story. That was exactly what I was hoping for, but more.
Yeah, she's had a life worth talking about. And I highly suggest everyone go read her book, Faithful. I've told you like the broad strokes, but it's the details that make the story.
Absolutely. That's what I say in my episodes especially the ones when I'm reading the full books. It's like, you've got to go and read it yourself, mm-hmm. especially this one that I'm going to be doing now with, you know, Angela Bowie. Halfway through the book, I've got to post it on every second page, and you can only hit so much in an hour. But absolutely. Then just bringing it back again to these incredible women and the mark that they left on rock and roll history that often goes either just kind of get pushed to the side, or mm-hmm. like I talked about in Michelle Overman's episode, literally pushed to the side so that they were out of the picture. But really, not only did they contribute to these amazing songs, but then they were also doing these incredible things themselves. And a lot of them had pretty rocky roads, and a lot of them, I mean, some of them didn't, but one thing that they all have in common is that they're incredible. And I'm happy to be able to have this opportunity to tell these stories.
Yeah, this is fantastic. These women all deserve to have their stories told, more than just through a song or, you know, through a memo, you know, some sentence in some rock god's book.
Exactly.
Yeah. They're all fantastic. And a lot of muses and groupies, sort of like you were saying, like they don't get, well, the credit that they deserve. And also a lot of them sort of have rocky roads after the fact, unless they have an outlet for their own creativity. Patty Boyd is a good example. Like, she inspired so much, but then when she separated from them, it was like, where do I go now? I don't really have anything, you know?
Mm-hmm, because they were essentially giving her an allowance to be mm-hmm. their wives, and because they didn't want her to work yeah. either. George and Eric didn't want her working and modeling and stuff, so it was essentially like, stay home. Yeah. And then when they weren't together anymore, they were like, oh, I guess she was like,
yeah, what about me?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I know B.B. Buell had said in her book, you know, Elvis took everything from me. Elvis mm-hmm. Costello, he mm-hmm. talked about the mascara that I used, the clothes that I wore. And she was like, where are my royalties?
Exactly. Yeah. Unless your name is on that that publishing rights, you're not going to see a penny. Oh, I should mention, when Sticky Fingers came out and the Stones covered Sister Morphine, they did not put Marianne on as a co-writer. They took her name off of it, but they did.
Why'd you do that?
Right? Exactly. They did give her 1/3 of the royalties for that, though. So they sort of did right by her, but they still... if you look it up, it says, like, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards wrote it.
Damn.
Yeah. sort of a slap in the face. And yeah, that's what like a lot of these women, like those songs wouldn't exist without their inspiration, but they don't profit from it at all, you know. And that's pretty rough, and unless you yourself are a musician or a writer. And like Pamela, you know, she had her books and she ended up using them as her muse.
Exactly, sort of that reverse then. And so now, like, you know, there's this thing online where, you know, Pamela was with Catherine James and she was with Miss Mercy, and Michael DeBar was just like, gotta pay attention to these women because they paved the way for, you know, very early feminists, and
absolutely,
they were doing what they wanted to do. And and then Pamela was just at this thing for Graham Parsons, because it was just like the anniversary of his birthday, and they were telling stories about how Chris Hillman wanted to play something on the GTO's records, that he wanted to play even the tambourine, and Frank Zappa kept saying no, no. So some of the greatest stories come from these women, and they were all really respected. There was a reason why people wanted to hang out with them. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
And I think that this word groupie just got tarnished at some point, where people just started associating it with
just like sex. People
just
think groupie
and only sex,
and,
and not that there's anything wrong with sex, but then, you know, stuff. And I keep saying, like, I've got to explore this a little bit further with things happening in the 80s, and you
it
know,
did
the bands,
get
like,
a little
things got a bit gross.
It was like at that time where it started turning into something seemingly vulgar, and then people started, you know, looking down on women who have every right to do whatever. That's why I love Cherry Vanilla as well. She loved sex. She loved rock and roll. She was her own woman, and she did not care what anybody thought of her. She was going to do what she wanted to do and screw anyone who, you know, tries to tell her otherwise. She really owned it. And so do all these other women. Pamela is another great example. And it's fantastic to see women in any way, like, own who they are, past just being a groupie. Like, just whatever you love, like, own it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I think that that's a perfect place to end. What a wonderful episode. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
It really means a lot.
Please have me
back.
Came back. Yeah.
And
anytime.
Wonderful. Well, I've got a little photo shoot to get ready for. But before we go, I'll just say, if you could take a moment to rate, subscribe, and review on iTunes, it would mean a lot. You know, this is as independent can get in terms of podcasts. And so if you do like the show, and if you are tuning in, it would mean a lot if you went and left a rating and a review, so that other people who would be interested in hearing these stories and who love music and maybe haven't necessarily heard the side of rock and roll can get to the stories as well.
Yes.
I really appreciate that.
Come support, and thanks for listening.
That's right. And you can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Muses and Stuff Podcast. And if you have a Muses or groupie story of your own, whatever it may be, send me an email, musesandstuff@gmail.com.
Awesome.
Thank you so much, Lynx.
Thank you.
And we'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. Wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you, and let's make season two even more memorable together.